Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now to discuss the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Vago.
Always a pleasure, Vago.
Highlight of the weekend, Vago.
Exactly. It is always a joy having you guys on. And for once, all of us are in places with terrific weather, whether in sunny Chatham, New Jersey, in London, where you are having a bout of summer. And of course, here in sunny Washington, D.C., where the weather has been terrific. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Bell sponsors, of course, this podcast. Gentlemen, all right, gentlemen, let's start off with the big news of the week that we have managed to discuss on every episode over the past week, the announcement by U.S. Air Force Acquisition Chief Will Roper that the Next Generation Air Dominance aircraft has not only been built but successfully flight tested, setting records along the way, all about a year from going from an electronic design all the way to a finished prototype. Apparently, the plane's subsystems were also tested on other platforms. There's a lot that we do not know at this point, in part, including the company, although I think we can surmise who that is, looking at who may have been getting a little bit more money than some of the other companies. But what I think is game-changing about this is, given that all four of us are airplane people, the speed with which this program appears to have come together, and Dr. Roper made clear that the reason he decided to disclose this was to send a message as the new E-Series aircraft and E-Series designation will be applied to systems that are electronically designed, whether aircraft, the T-7 by Boeing and Saab, is the first aircraft to be designated with that E that will be during the development phase of a weapon. They're doing the same thing in satellites. They're going to do the same thing when it comes to weapon systems so that we can transition through the development and test to production much more quickly. He used a Formula One analogy that, you know, Formula One moves as fast as it does with high technology, in part because of digital design threads, which everybody is shifting to. Ron, we're all airplane people. You're a super duper airplane person. You get the gold star because you're a PhD aerodynamicist, which I think is one of the coolest things around. And you're also an engineer's engineer, even though you're on Wall Street. Walk us through what you made of this news. And Richard, want to get your take. And then Sash, want to get your take on what this means for Tempest and the naysayers who say that a program like this, an ambitious program like this, can't be done quickly. Ron?
Yeah, I mean, it was clearly a welcome surprise, from a purely engineer's point of view, that, our industry still has the capability to be nimble and pull together something like this in a short time frame. We've heard estimates floating around that maybe they did it so far under a $2 billion price tag in a year or less than a year. Given current airplane development standards or whatever, you just kind of read across the industry, that's super fast and super cheap. So it's kudos to probably the Skunk Works. I would take a guess at that. I mean, you look at Lockheed's financials. Their aeronautics business seemed to have a little, a little bit of extra revenue floating around. Could be wrong, just a guess. But it was, I think welcome news there. The street, I would say, it didn't reflect itself really in the stocks this week. You didn't see, Lockheed take a bomb for Northrop or any of the usual suspects on it. I think it really does point to something that maybe we thought the industry couldn't do anymore, was be that nimble, pull it off that quick. Now, we don't know exactly what a flying prototype means. We don't know, exactly what they did, but, it's encouraging news, clearly.
Richard, you were always a little bit skeptical about the Century series, the digital Century series approach. What do you make of all of this, given how long you've been looking at combat aircraft as well as commercial aircraft, both development and production programs?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly echo Ron's thoughts about the just the welcomeness of this. You know, I was like, cool, we can still prototype, we can still be agile, we can still harness new technologies, and we're not reliant on vellum. But a couple things I'd keep in mind. One, we really don't know what's underneath the skin here. There's two possibilities. One is that it's old wine, new bottles, early stages of aircraft development, where the really hard work on the radar, EW, engines, of course, and God knows what else is still to come. In which case, wait a minute, you prioritized using billions of dollars on an airframe. We know how to build a good airframe. it's really the subsystems that are the enablers. And the other possibility is that, no, they are all new, amazing subsystems. It seems to me that that would be more in the $10+ billion range. I'm not so sure they would have hidden that, and it would have taken a lot longer to come up with new integrated EW and AESA radar, and of course engines. So what exactly is this? And if it's simply old wine, new bottles, SU-57 early days, Rafael in its early days, whatever else, then it seems a bit of a misallocation of resources relative to putting it into the enabling systems. That's going to be really interesting to watch. The other thing I can't help but wonder is if we aren't just being a bit too enamored of this digital thread concept. It's been around for a while, even on this E thing. Go back to 2003, Boeing's 787, as it was known back then, which of course became the 787, was touted as the big start of digitization. The E is for electronically designed. You know, I mean, we've had CAD/CAM in what, six generations now. It's all very good to pretend that MBSE and all this other stuff is some sort of revolution, but it's really been with us for some time. And so has the use of E as a cool enabling signifier, if you will, or signifying enabler or what have you, to say nothing of the fact that it's often used for electronic combat aircraft and has been for many decades.
Let me just counterpoint that, right? Saab going to model-based design has really, game-changed in terms of where it bends the key bends the learning curve. They maintain something around 30 airplanes as opposed to 150, which is where you normally get. That's one of the things that apparently is enabling their A-26 submarine program. But more specifically, Dr. Roper said that the subsystems on this plane have already been developed. And if you, and we had a great conversation with Michelle Evans, the Lockheed Martin Aeronautics chief, last week as well. And she talked about the fact that there could, that the F-35 DNA and subsystems and sensor capability is something that was a national investment that's been made. So if you actually want to build an NGAD that maybe is a bigger, larger, longer ranged combat aircraft, there is a lot you might be able to do with the existing engine technology, maybe do something with Advent that money has been going into as well. And then you look at some of the core architectures that could be built around the F-35 combat system, which arguably is a tremendous combat system. It's connected to a much smaller single engine sort of tactical strike fighter, as opposed to the kind of bigger, air dominance F-22 class airplane that they're looking at. So I'm just like sort of filling in a little bit of the details from my standpoint. Sash, give us your sense. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. For me, that's actually the dream scenario, and I hope it's that. You know, the old joke that for many years, the F-22 was an amazing air vehicle in search of a really good mission equipment package, and the F-35 was a really good mission equipment package in search of a good air vehicle. If this is all a way of rectifying that conundrum, which was, of course, mooted in a reborn F-22 back 5-6 years ago, if this is that, I think that's kind of a dream scenario. Absolutely.
Sash, let's go over to you. A lot of naysayers, obviously, when Britain launched Tempest. We've been covering it for a couple of years. I think people didn't recognize and still might not recognize that this was a black program for several years before it came into the light at Farnborough, so 5 years ago now. And if you look at
Only four years ago. 3, actually.
Okay, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're absolutely right. My apologies.
Time flies when we're having so much fun.
Time flies when we're having so much fun. Exactly. And Long story short, whether it's 3 years or 4 years or whatever it is, the program was already nascent and working for a while. And what we've got now is Sweden is part of the program. Italy is part of the program. There is an existential sense among the three nations that the future of their combat aircraft heritage and legacy rests on the success of this program. What are the things that you're picking up? How do you interpret this? And what do you think it means for Tempest or even the F-35 program?
Okay, yeah, I mean, I'll start. It's very rare of me, except possibly in the A380, to pick a fight with Richard, particularly so early in the recording. But I'll just very gently chide him on his sort of recollection of the early days of the Eurofighter program and Rafale. I think that BAE Systems, or British Aerospace as it then was, and the UK aerospace industry overall found what was called the Experimental Aircraft Program, EAP, but was effectively a prototype Eurofighter, to be an incredibly effective way of de-risking the aircraft configuration, the flight control system, and so forth, far earlier on in the program than they otherwise would have done. And similarly, Dassault with the Rafale A, which was in many respects a subscale version of the aircraft that we now know as the Rafale. I mean, it's good 15% smaller physically, and certainly very underpowered compared to Rafale, but it de-risked a hell of a lot. So I think this doing rapid prototyping, putting aircraft in the air, and then sort of having a vision as to how you're going to bring various combat systems and so forth into the into the program thereafter, is a really good way to take risk out. Time is cost in all the industries that I think we cover. And the converse of that is lack of time means a lower cost. $1.7 billion is chump change for a new combat aircraft program. If this has been achieved, NGAD is built and flying for 1.7 billion. That shows what you can do when you focus, frankly, do it in the black, do it without people looking over your shoulder and naysaying the whole time. And I think that Tempest in particular, Team Tempest, will take huge comfort from this. This shows that the Tempest concept can work, and in all respects probably is working. I think a commitment to Tempest is going to be one of the most important things that comes out of the UK Defence Review. And I've always said, I think that Tempest is moving at a potentially faster rate than the Franco-German-Spanish FCAS SCAF program. And I think that this will cause the French and the Germans, where there are very, very, particularly in Germany, a pretty slow budget cycle, I think it will cause them some concern. But to come back to, what does this mean for the F-35, particularly the export markets? F-35 has been marketed very successfully for 20 years as the only game in town. It's the only, nth generation fighter. The export customer, are never going to get anything else. This is what the US Air Force in particular is putting all its money into. So, don't even think of looking for something else. This is the future. And NGAD pulls the rug from under the F-35 in export marketing. Firstly, if you look, the US Air Force has pushed a lot of its F-35 buy out into the late 20s, early 30s, mid 30s. Do you believe that's actually going to be held, or are they just going to chop that off and switch the money to NGAD? Most export customers will be concerned that the US Air Force commitment to F-35 will end quicker than they want. Paradoxically, I think this is something that is going to, it's going to cause is causing a hell of a stir in the European combat aircraft industry, but by no means all of that is negative. I think actually it really does show that you can bring very advanced programs to prototype stage fast and at an acceptable price. And probably Tempest is the one that takes the greatest heart from that.
I should point out that the $1.7 billion number was from Todd Harrison of CSIS, and I can't remember now if that's a multi-year number or if it was a single-year number. But still, you know, not a lot of money. And as for timings, Sash, you were right. It was at 2018. What I was talking about is at the time that that announcement was made at Farnborough last, when last we all convened in person, and sadly the show didn't become virtual as it did this year because of the coronavirus. It was 3 years before that mark. So I was saying 5 years, and that included the couple of years of black work that had happened behind the curtain. Richard, I know you want to jump in, and Ron, I want to give you an opportunity to dive in on this as well. Go ahead, Richard, and then we can go to Ron.
Yeah, thanks, Vago. And you know, you're not going to succeed in enraging me by merely saying A380 there, Sash. Just, although, you know, I do feel a little bit, you know, nevertheless, slightly provoked. But no, I mean, I think I agree with you. You know, it's just that you're also kind of making my point. I mean, EAP and Rafale, you know, A minus or whatever it was, those were all 80s planes, and they proved the concept even using last generation systems. But then the hard lifting, the hard spending was decades ahead. So if you'd said, wow, look what we've achieved. We've flown the EAP, was it 83, 84 or something like that. And we only did it for, you know, $1 billion or $2 billion or whatever. That meant nothing because it was still decades away and billions of dollars from being able to deploy a next generation effective weapons system. So that's exactly what I mean, that if it is an example of that, then digitization hasn't accomplished very much because all the heavy lifting is still to come.
Ron, your view of all of this?
Yeah, a couple points I would add. I guess I don't see how this would impact export markets. Because if it's truly NGAD, we never exported F-22, and I can't imagine that the U.S. would want to export its next best thing in that market. I could be wrong. So I'm not as worried about the impact on export markets from this aircraft if it eventually matures to the point where we have reasonable production rate program. And then maybe the second point, if you look at the way...
I just want to point out that there was a lot of talk about international cooperation and partnership, right? So if you're the United States and you want to make sure you have a dominant seat, you may open up this fighter to participation from other allied nations in order for you to stay in the catbird seat and they not have their own competing airplane, right? I mean, I'm not trying to make a cynical observation, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a fair point. And then the second point, if you look at, you know, business jet development, and what the folks in the commercial aircraft industry have done for years, you know, it's kind of playing with Legos. I mean, particularly, you know, I like to call it, you know, with all due respect to Textron, the Cessna model, right? You can play with different wings and tubes and engines and avionics. And I mean, there's got to be enough kit out there in, you know, the U.S. You know, tactical fighter, development industry that you should be able to snap together something relatively quickly at a relatively low cost with a lot of existing stuff that could get you to a prototype as long as I think it was Richard who pointed out, you're not hindered by a lot of people looking over your shoulder saying, what are you doing? So, I mean, if you had the luxury of doing this in a relatively small, nimble, lowly observed way, it doesn't seem like too much of a stretch of the imagination that you could pull together something pretty quickly.
Coronavirus infections are on the rise in Europe. France passed the 10,000 new cases a day mark. Britain, as we discussed a little bit last week, had done no more than 6 people together, and it looks like cases are also on the rise. In the United States, there's a concern that as winter approaches and people have really been getting back to normal, there might be another resurgence. When it comes to economic impacts, obviously in front of Congress, there's been the Democratic stimulus package that was passed all the way back in May. There's been a lot of debate and discussion. The GOP did a slim down, cover your butt version for the Olympics, for the elections or the political Olympics. And then we saw that the White House is now sort of echoing a little bit about of what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been saying, to do a bigger stimulus. Obviously, a lot of concern about airline funding that's running out. Ron, what do, and let's quickly go around the horn, what do markets expect from lawmakers at this point, given that some of the economic numbers have been softening, retail sales have been softening in the UK, right? There's deflationary pressure that people are talking about in part because of the the subsidization of go out to eat is causing. What do markets want to see from governments, and how soon do they want to see it? And Sash, want to get your take on that. And then Richard, I want to talk to you about a little bit about air travel trends if this gets as bad as people fear it will.
Yeah, so let me kick it off by saying, broadly, just qualifying, I'm not Bank of America strategist, so this is just Ron speaking from my aerospace aperture. But if you look at the broader market, if some sort of deal doesn't come through, I would imagine the market will see that as negative. The corollary being, I do think the market is pricing in some level of government intervention. And then if you take in the aperture even more and you look at the aerospace side of things, the market, I think for sure, is pricing in some level of intervention at the airlines. If indeed, we get to October 1st and nothing happens and you see the level of layoffs that have been, I was going to say clearly telegraphed, but more than telegraphed, I mean, kind of put up in spotlight, that are going to happen at the U.S. airlines, that in the end will be, most likely unwelcome news. So there's some expectation for that. And then I would say that the last point, and you've seen this a bit in the way that the commercial aerospace stocks have been trading, there was a hope, maybe even an expectation, that we would be farther along in the recovery than we are in terms of air traffic. Really the only market in the world that hasn't really stalled out down, 70% is the Chinese domestic market. But even if you look at the total Chinese market, it's still down 20% year on year, which by any historical measure is horrific. And that's the best one. So, I think expectations are cautiously optimistic around government intervention, but pretty realistic around what's going on in commercial aerospace markets.
Sash?
Look, whether we are in coronavirus phase one or phase two is, frankly, semantics. It's clearly getting worse again. It's getting very much worse in Europe. France is back to numbers of cases which exceed what they were like in Q2. Ditto Spain. The UK, the number of cases is doubling every week at the moment, and we're heading for another nationwide lockdown of some description. This is dreadful for commercial aerospace, and commercial aerospace stocks are generally, with the exception of Rolls-Royce, which I'll come back to, but commercial aerospace stocks are, they've run off the edge of the cliff, and they're still just sort of running in midair. It's the classic cartoon character. They haven't started the headlong fall yet. But the idea that we're not going to see commercial aerospace companies cut production radically, I think is, verging on irresponsible. The only question is when they do it. Do they do it with their Q3 numbers, which will be in about a month and change time, or do they wait until Q4? But every single company that we look at, particularly in Europe, has got forward-looking guidance that says our guidance is predicated on there being no worsening of the COVID environment. Well, actually, that's exactly what is happening now, unfortunately. And, Ron's absolutely right. China is the shining exception. But a lot of companies were saying at the H1 results, isn't China doing well? Everybody else will get back to, Chinese levels in the second half of the year. Ain't happening. And that's very, very worrying indeed. And certainly, just looking at a wide range of share prices, they're not reflecting this sort of reality at the moment.
And we should point out, right, the Chinese numbers, if you can believe the Chinese numbers in full, I guess, would always be a caveat. Richard, what's your sense, and how do you think this is going to manifest in ridership? And then maybe Sash, right? Your colleague Nick Cunningham has put together, his latest analysis. So if you want to kind of riff on that, would be great to get your view on it as well. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, there has been, of course, a strong level of denial and expectations of a rapid rebound. Those have been delusional for some time. On the other hand, I would offer a few I guess, data points or concepts that may offer some hope. You know, everyone's been focused upon IATA's return to 2019 levels of peak air transport demand in 2024. We're still at late 2023. I think there's a reasonable chance that it might be a bit better than that, just because, you know, you look at that combination of relatively quick testing that's coming out now for antigens, hopefully soon coronavirus, temperature checks at airports, and the fact that there's really been shockingly few, if any, cases of people contracting this thing on a jet.
Although, Richard, I should point out, right, the Centers for Disease Control are saying nearly 11,000 people have been exposed to the virus on flight. So it's not like it's completely risk-free. And my understanding is that we don't have... I don't know if there have been any fatalities tied to it. But anyway, your point.
My point is that even that's a tiny number of exposure and very few, if any, confirmed cases got it on the plane. And not only that, that was before testing procedures were put in place, because those tests are just becoming available now and are going to get better and better. And then another data point I'd point out is that, you know, when this crisis began, private jet travel was also having a terrible heart attack in terms of percent declines year over year. September numbers are just out. They're down 12%. That isn't good. But on the other hand, hey, compared to the 70-80% down on commercial, it's fantastic. I'll take it. It clearly shows that when people feel good about traveling, they're getting back to traveling. Matter of fact, you could have a complete recovery in the private jet sector, you know, by the end of the year. That's not to say that we should adjust from 2023-2024 towards level of peak demand, but it might be okay. It's just that 2021 for OEMs, for everybody involved, certainly the MRO business, it's going to be an absolutely horrible year. But, you know, 2022 might look very, very different. Even third or fourth quarter 2021 might give us that kind of wonderful sensation you get when you're not at peak, but you're increasing at double-digit numbers every month, getting back there. That has a different psychological effect to it. So while I see the dangers of what's coming, I'm also kind of hopeful that stuff is happening that could hasten our recovery.
I should point out, though, that Yale University did a study of fatalities in the United States and think that the number of coronavirus fatalities may actually be underreported by about 25. I can't remember if it was 26, 25, or 28%, but let's say that ballpark, which is now rounding at about the 200,000 mark. Ron, you wanted to add something, and then Sash, we can go to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, so quickly, I mean, if you think about maybe how companies are thinking about the recovery, just this last week, Raytheon Technologies announced that they were going to be reducing their workforce in the commercial business by 15,000 jobs. Just a couple of months ago, that was 8,000 jobs. So they almost doubled the size of their workforce reductions, you know, kind of getting ready for, you know, a recovery that's clearly not as robust as they had been hoping. And then the other thing I might bring up is this week was also the Speed News Toulouse conference, you know, commercial suppliers conference. And one of the speakers brought up, and I believe it was a speaker from Boeing, and I'm going to get these numbers probably a little bit wrong, but the chance of catching COVID in a grocery store is something like 6.6%. And on a commercial aircraft, it's well below that, approximately maybe an order of magnitude lower than that. So flying on a plane is safer in, you know, just kind of everyday terms than going to the grocery store, much safer than that. So I don't know. I mean, if that, you know, gets people flying, but ultimately it really does seem you need a reason to fly, right? So the reason, you know, Speed News was virtual is because nobody was going to Toulouse for the conference. So that's probably one of the big barriers that we got to overcome. And then the last piece is the economic impact, right? So, you know, even when, you know, the virus is, we have a vaccine out there and you get distribution, is there going to be some lingering effect in the economy? And I think that's just an open question. You know, I don't think any economist can really answer that very confidently, because there really isn't much modern historical experience with this kind of downturn.
Sash, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, just a couple of things. I mean, you know, the data points we've been looking at, my colleague Nick Cunningham has been looking at, Eurocontrol, European air movements were about 51-52% down year on year for most of August and into early September, but actually now down
54%, and the last week down 57% down year on year. So basically there was a summer bump when things, you know, we got up to only 50% down. And Eurocontrol, European aircraft movements have really turned down quite substantially in the last week or so. And you can see a, you know, you can see the post-labor or, you know, the post-holiday effect also on TSA passenger checkpoints. Just to pick up though on this propensity to fly, I don't think many people do or don't fly because they're worried about catching coronavirus in the cabin. Because if you're in most airlines, you're in the cabin, you're wearing a mask, which some people clearly do not like doing. But yeah, you know, you are pretty safe in the cabin itself. The airport experience is, you know, actually quite, and this is speaking with a great deal of experience from, you know, a small number of people who have been doing it recently, the airport experience is okay. The problem is the testing pre and post and what happens if it all goes wrong. That it's hard to get the testing within 24 hours in a lot of countries, even if you pay. It's hard to get the test back quickly enough. And many countries are then insisting you go into quarantine, you know, whether you're clear or not. And overcoming these governmental bureaucratic issues to flight, I think, is the thing that is stopping people from flying. Not that individuals, us, are scared about catching a cough on a plane. It's the sheer hassle factor and the degree to which, you know, we might be severely constrained at the other end.
Well, exactly. And for a lot of people, they sort of don't have really anywhere to go, right? I mean, those conferences, those meetings, those trade shows aren't happening. And increasingly, everybody is scheduling this stuff right virtually. So that takes that pressure off. Time is running short. I want to talk about 737 SASH. There are 2 points on rolls, as well as what used to once upon a time be called Telefunken, latter day, then Airbus, and then Hensoldt. But let's quickly talk about 737 MAX. The House released its exhaustive review, found fault across the board, whether at Boeing's safety culture, misleading certifiers, not as good of a culture of certification at the Federal Aviation Administration. At the end of the day, let's quickly go around the horn. What did you guys glean from this that we didn't know, and just use this as an opportunity to sort of bring everybody up to speed on Boeing? There looked like there were a couple of more tanker issues that were discussed at AFA on KC-46 refueling receptacles. Obviously, this tanker can take gas from another tanker, and those seals were replacing. The airplanes were taken, I think, to Greenville to have that leak repaired. And then obviously everybody is looking at the new refueling system being installed and retrofitted on the planes to allow them to. Anyway, let's just use this as an opportunity for a quick across the piece Boeing update. Ron, why don't you start us off and let's quickly go around the horn?
Yeah, I don't think the House report really said anything new that we haven't heard one way or another, you know, over the last several months. It just sort of, put it all together in one document. You know, they highlighted, you know, technical miscalculations at the company and management misjudgments. But they also, you know, pointed a finger at the FAA saying, you know, their oversight, you know, function was in question, and that, you know, I think to quote, you know, they were grossly insufficient oversight. And, you know, as you know, there's a form of legislation working its way. Actually, I think it's through the House and I think it didn't get through the Senate on, you know, changing the FAA delegation system. And it seems like both sides want something to happen. It's just sort of hit a bump. But for me, anyway, I guess the bigger takeaway is that there does seem to be some momentum behind modifying the oversight at the FAA. That makes sense. But on the Boeing front, I don't think we really learned much new.
Sash?
I agree with Ron. I don't think we learned much more than we've been discussing at almost any time over the last 18 months, actually. But, you know, it brings it all in one place.
Richard, is that your sense as well?
That is. I mean, you know, the one narrative that emerged from the week is that it was a somewhat politicized document. I actually go the other direction. I don't think it was politicized enough. You know, the real issue here, I think, has been maybe an unquestioned headlong continuation of what was once a very sound legacy of deregulation in Washington. You know, the Reagan Revolution, a lot of it was very good. And then the party probably went on too far. And whether the result was an under-resourced and under-authorized FAA or, you know, an under-resourced EPA in Flint, Michigan or whatever, the consequences have been dire. And I think Washington needs to have a good, hard look about look at itself in the mirror and say, hey, have we gone too far with deregulation and starving the beast and under-resourcing regulators? Because I think that's a huge issue. And, you know, you can talk about changing the representation rule, the delegation rule, and all that other stuff, but if you don't provide the necessary resources to do spot checks and necessary authority to implement fines and whatever against people who've done something wrong, then across the board, whether it's in this area of regulation or another discipline, you're going to have problems in the future. In other words, Washington needs to look at itself as much as it looks at Boeing and even the FAA.
I couldn't agree more, right? I mean, if you've got experts who are minding, whether in defense acquisition or any other medical field or anything else, if you've got experts who are on the government side and are sharp and are willing to trust but can verify, that keeps everybody honest at the end of the day, and you make clear what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And as a general rule, that's always something that's makes sense. Anyway, very quickly, if no other objections, Sash, we didn't talk as much about Europe. Talk to us a little bit about the Rolls-Royce statement in terms of equity. They're going to raise quite a lot of equity. And then Hensoldt, Airbus, Telefunken Systems Technique, which I would like you to say once in the course of answering the question, just because I think it's one of those great names that's kind of no more.
Yeah, okay. I mean, this is, you know, it's very interesting. Two European companies are raising very, very significant amounts of cash, already saying that they are minded to. Rolls-Royce has put out a statement over the weekend saying that they are considering, although they've not yet, you know, pulled the trigger on it, an equity raise of up to 2.5 billion sterling. Well, given that the company was capitalized last week at 3.5 billion sterling, that's effectively doubling, pretty much doubling the number of shares in issue. That is enormous. Now, they may try to do other things as well or other things instead, but this shows quite how badly Rolls-Royce has been affected by COVID. It has blown the company's business model of focusing on wide-bodied aircraft, focusing on power by the hour. That has just been blown absolutely out of the water, and the company is horribly damaged financially by that, and the cost to mend it is going to be huge. I don't think we're going to know for several weeks yet. There is a deadline, but the deadline isn't until this time next year, but it's when a revolving credit facility of about 1.9 billion expires. They clearly feel that they need to do something this calendar year, though. On the flip side, we haven't had an IPO of a big defense company or big defense aerospace company in Europe for a while, but Hensoldt, which is the former Airbus defense and space sensors business, and as you said, used to be known once upon a time as Telefunken System Technique, is IPOing. They're going to raise, they're looking for a capitalization of about 2 billion euros, plus or minus, and they'll raise about a quarter of that in the next week or so. Very, very interesting company, because this is the business that is the German counterpart to Thales on the SCAF, FCAS program. It's the sensor house for a lot of the German armored vehicle industry and part of the naval industry. It's the German counterpart to Leonardo Selex and on the Eurofighter, various Eurofighter radars, but it's a lot smaller. So, you know, the bull case is, well, you know, you're getting a sort of supercharged defense electronics business in a very, very small package. Won't that be nice? My concern is it's been in private equity for a long time. doesn't seem to me to spend a huge amount on R&D. So it's what it's doing is relying on the German government to do the spending for it, particularly in terms of the E-scan radar for Eurofighter. It may all work very well, but it's self-funded R&D does not impress compared to Thales, Leonardo, or even Saab. And people always underestimate quite how much Saab spends on radars. Just one final point. Today is the celebrations or the commemoration of the 80th anniversary of what's referred to as Battle of Britain Day, which was the arguably the biggest single air battle over London and the southeast, and was pretty much the Luftwaffe's, or you know, the Luftwaffe's last effort to break the RAF in that battle, and we were very, very privileged to have the Battle of Britain Memorial flight fly past us earlier on this morning after a church service in central London.
Everybody, thanks very, very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Hope you all have a great week, and looking forward to having you back on for another great conversation next week. Thanks so much.
Good to be here, Vago. Thank you.
Thanks, Vago, as always.
Great to be here, Vago. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.